Chapter 19. Feet of Clay. General von Bülow, a member of an extraordinary family of diplomats and military men, more than 100 Bülows would take part in the war, and 70% of them would be killed or wounded, and General von Kluck continued to pursue the fleeing French at full speed. However, von Kluck, suddenly stripped of 150,000 elite troops, had to rein in his right flank, which would have swept to Pontoise, to the west of Paris, between the French capital and the Atlantic. He pulled back towards Meaux, to the east of Paris, where it was still entirely possible that, once across the Marne, he might link up with the German 6th and 7th armies to General Joffre's rear. The Germans advanced on all fronts for some days. Almost immediately after the German victory at Charleroi on August 26, the 1st British Army Corps was severely beaten at Le Cateau by von Kluck. On August 29, 1914, the defeated Lannerzach tried courageously to aid the fleeing British, but the latter demurred. They had suffered terrible losses, 100,000 men in 1 month. Now the British wanted only to return by forced marches to the ports of Dunkirk and Calais. An old habit, at Waterloo, when Wellington was in doubt as to whether he could repel Napoleon's attack, he prepared for a retreat through the forest of Soignies, between the battlefield and Brussels, and had already sent relays ahead to the northwest in order to be able to re-embark his army without too much disorder if the Emperor won the day. Similarly, the British commander, Marshal French, in the days of August 1914, felt a raging desire to cut and run. He was more drawn to London fogs than to spiked helmets. Farreau, the historian, tells us, La Grande Guerre, page 104, French wished to save what was left of his army, and, judging the French marshals incapable of pulling themselves together, he had thought of re-embarking. It was with difficulty that Lannerzach coaxed the British troops back into the retreating columns. Meanwhile, General von Kluck had reached Noyon. He was advancing on Ferté-Milon and on Compiègne. By August 31, he was very close to cornering the French armies southeast of Paris. He had passed the valley of the Orc and reached Château Thierry, pressing hard on the heels of the French, who crossed the bridges of the Marne before him, barely escaping him. In 1 week the armies of von Kluck and von Bülow had reached the heart of France, on foot, because troops at that time still had to rely on their legs to get any place while campaigning. Hundreds of thousands of German soldiers had taken the crossings of the Aisne and the Vesle at Bayonet Point beneath the hot August sun. They had come, as Corneille had once said, to the verge of a total victory, just a few tens of kilometers from Paris. Their eyes sparkled with joy. In another week they would be able to close the trap in the rear of the main body of the French army. Von Moltke's order of the day of September 2, 1914 was for his troops to strike the knockout blow. For 3 weeks the French public had learned next to nothing of the front. At the start of August 1914 the chatterboxes of the press, so convincing when it was a matter of getting their readers to underwrite the Russian loans, were bursting with wondrous details about the new super weapon, a slice of French bread and butter that, like a magnet, would draw the famished Huns to it as one man. The newspapers hushed up almost completely the disasters of the Ardennes and of Charleroi. On August 28 they finally revealed that the enemy's cavalry was at the Marne, then, the next day, that the French capital itself was threatened, and on that day Poincaré's government fled with its tail between its legs. That news started the headlong flight of a half million Parisians, heading helter-skelter towards the south. Poincaré and his gang, absconding from the Élysée, took refuge in Bordeaux and didn't show their faces in Paris again until 3 months later, in November 1914, when the big scare was over. The commander-in-chief of the French armies, General Joffre, was a man as calm as a locomotive sitting in a railroad station. He was so dull of eye one never knew whether he was awake or asleep. A massive man and a monument of serenity, he was a big eater and slept a great deal. Some said he was an incompetent dullard. Whatever the case, he was unshakable, constant in his faults, and proceeded slowly. Charles de Gaulle would write, having badly engaged his sword, he knew he couldn't lose his balance. One more week of retreat, and the German 1st, Second, Third, Fourth, and Fifth Armies could easily join up behind his troops in Champagne. His meals did not suffer because of it, nor did his sleep. He was supremely calm, and without a single unnecessary word set up his chessmen again each time he was overwhelmed, putting his military pawns back in place. He vowed resolve even while retreating. From Joffre's directive of September 1, 1914, the flanking movement carried out by the enemy on the left wing of the Fifth Army, and not sufficiently arrested by the British troops of the Sixth Army, makes it necessary for our entire formation to wheel around its right side. After the thunderclap of the two great defeats of August 24 and 25, Joffre drew from the less threatened sectors those elements which would permit reorganizing of the Fifth Army to new strength. He entrusted the reorganization to General Monnery. His mission: stop the rout before Amiens by August 27. It was too late for that. The army was only able to reassemble well into the rear of the town. Militarily, Paris was almost defenseless at the end of August 1914. The capital was only sketchily protected by worthy territorials, who were more liberally endowed with rheumatism than with military equipment. Its air defense was limited to a total of 9 planes, 3 of them Voisins, and to 2 75mm self-propelled howitzers. General Gallieni had been named commander of Paris by the fleeing politicians. In poor health, he would die 2 years later. He was a competent and clever officer, far superior to the placid Joffre, whom he treated, moreover, with a condescension that was rather irritating. But he was the man whom France needed that week. To calm the Parisians who hadn't fled, he had his brigade of grandpas march through the city 10 or 12 times. From near Amiens he drew 7 regular divisions of the new army formed on August 27, which were reinforced on September 1 by 2 divisions from the 4th Army Corps retreating from Saint-Menehould. In the end, he had 15 divisions. The Germans continued their dash to the southeast of Paris, but now on their right flank 15 French divisions under a bold and dynamic commander were watching for the false step that would enable an attack precisely where the enemy were missing the 150,000 men suddenly sent to the Eastern Front. Moltke's headquarters was far from the battle. That would prove to be another big mistake on his part. Instead of installing himself at Laon or at Soissons, or at least at Charleroi, from where he could follow the fighting from fairly close at hand, in an era when communication was still slow and unreliable, he set up his headquarters in Luxembourg, a few miles from Germany. His armies advanced some 300 kilometers with impunity while he sat glued to his armchair in the old feudal town nestled beneath a somber castle. His messengers had to spend hours of travel on bad roads in cars that endangered the driver. He exceeded 60 kilometers per hour to reach the front. His remoteness from the action would be one of the major causes of the defeat. Von Moltke was to suffer a week later at the Marne, a river he would never see. Isolated, entirely dependent upon the belated reports of messengers, von Moltke sent back orders that reached the front line hours late, and dispatched delegations top-heavy with second-rate staffers. The latter, mandated by von Moltke to make immediate decisions in his name, had to be obeyed by the army generals who, right there on the scene, were better informed. They were thus not directly in command, which meant that they were not in command at all. Their commander was an aged Thor sitting on high in the clouds of Luxembourg, and he would not descend from his throne until he had been dismissed. Von Moltke wouldn't open his eyes to the danger until too late. Joffre had assembled troops of the First Army before Paris. Still retreating, in order to gain time, the French generalissimo added reinforcements from his armies in Lorraine, where the danger was less obvious. Moltke would not be informed of the French reinforcement from Lorraine until September 4, 1914. It would be September 5 before he, too, decided to bring up 2 army corps from the Lorraine front to reinforce the German offensive, now at the end of its momentum. These 2 army corps, like those which were diverted to the Eastern Front, would not serve any purpose either, spending the decisive days traveling, 40 to a car, in cattle cars. Von Moltke got no clear idea of the maneuver the French were preparing before Paris until a week later. Panicky Moltke finally discerned the threat, it must be assumed that the enemy is assembling heavy forces in the region of Paris and bringing in new units in order to defend the capital and to threaten the German right flank. The German right flank was von Kluck's army. Following orders, he had advanced farther and farther to the south beyond the Marne, well in advance of the thrust of von Billow's second army. The objective was now almost within reach. In conformity with the orders they had received on September 4, writes the French historian Renouvin, the German 4th and 5th armies were trying to open a road to the south in order to join up with the armies of Lorraine that were trying to force the passage of the Moselle and the Meurthe. It was there the German command was seeking the decision. Von Kluck had deliberately shot ahead and was within an ace of victory. 24 years later Rommel would do the same thing, but in each case the risk was great. Only one of von Kluck's army corps, the 4th Reserve Corps, on the Ourcq, guarded his right flank which was threatened by Paris. Gallieni badgered Joffre. He pointed out the possibility of striking a slashing blow right at von Kluck's rear. He could count on his 15 divisions, the British and General Lannerzac's 5th Army, now commanded by the future Marshal, Franchet d'Esperey. The British had finally consented to back him up, without enthusiasm to be sure, and after anguished debate, Marshal French did not agree. He considered giving battle premature and preferred to continue the retreat, falling back behind the Marne. Moreover, he was not ready to take part in a battle where he would have to engage all his forces at one time. Joffre, who wished to have done with it, decided to throw his sword into the balance and went to see French. With ill-concealed emotion, he said, "In the name of France, Marshal French, I ask you for your total assistance. This time, the honor of England is at stake." There was tension in the air. Joffre knew that Murray, French's assistant, was opposed to the counteroffensive. A heavy silence ensued. French replied almost inaudibly, "I will do all I can." Faro, La Grande Guerre, pages 10f. Joffre breathed a sigh of relief. The French divisions assembled for the counterattack now numbered 28. The Germans would be able to oppose them with only 14 divisions in the Paris area. From 1 against 1 to 2 to 1. An opportunity for a flanking maneuver such as is rarely offered in warfare had arisen. After long reflection and hesitation, Joffre made his decision on September 4. He was going to play his secret card. The French Generalissimo's order of the day. "It behooves us to take advantage of the risky situation of the German First Army and concentrate the efforts of the Allied armies on the extreme left flank against it." Gallieni proposed attacking Meaux. During the entire day of September 5, he pressed his luck north of the Marne grappling with the flank guard, the 4th Reserve Corps, of von Kluck's army. The next day, September 6, the offensive began. For 3 days it would be a fight to the death. France, indeed, was deciding whether she would live or die. Von Kluck defended himself with firmness and valor. But in bringing his army corps to the north bank of the Marne, he drifted away from von Bülow, his neighbor. Across a gap of 50 kilometers, they were linked only by a screen of cavalry. The German generals, we read in Renouvin, La Crise Européenne, page 249, didn't overlook that danger, rather counting on their offensive to protect them from it. By means of a vigorous attack on both extremities of the combat front they intended to seize victory before the breach was wide open. Kluck brought all his effort to bear on his right wing and the Ourcq plateaus, where he sought to outflank Monnery's army from the north. Bülow hurled his left wing across the marshes of Saint-Gond against Foch's army. On the morning of the 9th, those attacks, despite the stubborn resistance of the French troops, still looked most promising. The Germans, an ancient people of disciplined soldiers admirably trained in defensive as well as offensive warfare, returned blow for blow despite their numerical inferiority. To relieve his right wing, von Moltke had sent the Crown Prince into action with all his forces. The Kaiser's son had been on the point of capturing Verdun, which Joffre had already authorized Sarrail to evacuate. To the north of the Marne, Bülow was grappling, still victoriously, with Foch's attacks. The battle, Ferro relates, La Grande Guerre, page 101, raged for several days, with the adversaries trying to maneuver on the wings. Threatened on his left side, Bülow had to call on the armies of the center. Von Hausen drew nearer to him and assisted him in closing the breach. Farther off to the east, the French had gone on the offensive as well, but it was the Germans in the last analysis who led the operation. The withdrawal to the right bank of the Marne was accomplished by von Kluck in perfect order. That same day, Monnery narrowly escaped being overwhelmed by von Kluck, and Gallieni was forced to requisition the Parisian taxis in order to send him reinforcements without loss of time, Ferro, Ibid. That episode has become famous, it is the epinal image of Gallieni. Seeing that the offensive was in danger of taking a bad turn, the quick-witted Gallieni rounded up every ramshackle conveyance in Paris, loaded in all the soldiers who were still left in the capital, and rushed them in the direction of the enemy. It was the first motorized expedition in history. An unknown then entered on the scene. A mere lieutenant colonel, a German named Hench, his own authority, in comparison with that of the two army commanders, was non-existent. But as von Moltke's personal emissary commander-in-chief, he had been empowered to issue orders in the field in the name of the generals von Kluck and von Bülow, lacking direct instructions from their chief, were trying to coordinate their operations. Von Moltke should have been in a position to give the necessary orders at once. Ex-Chancellor Prince von Bülow wrote. Moltke should have allowed the three armies of the right wing to obtain their own information on the spot and thus assure strategic unity. Instead of taking that course, at the decisive moment, on September 8, he sent a section commander from his staff, Lieutenant Colonel Hench, authorized him to make decisions, mentioned the possibility of a retreat in the last verbal instructions he gave him, and even added some indication of the direction of a possible retreat. Of all the officers on his staff, Hench was the most susceptible to doubts, and it was for precisely that reason that he had the sympathy of his chief. Hench held the fate of the battle in his hands, and the fate of campaign, army, and country as well, and when he received an unfavorable impression of the situation in the headquarters of the Second Army, he recommended to Field Marshal General von Bülow, the commander of that army, that he retreat towards the northeast. Immediately afterwards he proceeded to General von Kluck, the commander of the First Army, and similarly urged him to pull back. Memoirs, pages 171f. At that crucial moment, a mere lieutenant colonel who had just stepped from his liaison car was making the strategic and tactical decisions of the battle. Ferro, La Grande Guerre, page 102, stated, Lieutenant Colonel Hench, given complete authority by Moltke back at general headquarters in Luxembourg, ordered von Kluck and von Bülow to carry out a general withdrawal. Renouvin, the French historian, after interviewing various German historians after the war, reported their conclusions, the German armies were on the point of victory. Even on the right wing, they were very close to success. Kluck on the Ourcq and Bülow on the Saint-Gond Marsh were in a position to smash the enemy and should have been given a few more hours, that would have been enough to change the outcome. The man responsible for the defeat was Lieutenant Colonel Hench, Moltke's deputy to the army commanders. He lacked the necessary firmness of character. When one last effort was all that was needed for victory, he thought the troops beaten. As with all victories and all defeats, discussion could go on forever. Excuses of misfortune change nothing. Misfortune, said Napoleon, is the excuse of incompetence and blunderers. The French attack at the Marne was courageously conceived at a time when the situation was nearly desperate. Joffre, indifferent to adversity, and with remarkable imperturbability, issued his orders with sang-froid. Monnery, during those days, lit up the Battle of the Marne with his brilliance. Wars abound in the unforeseeable, but the excellence of the French command was a reality. The victory did not bring total salvation, the proof is that the war quickly bogged down on the Western Front for 4 years. The Battle of the Marne saved France from a catastrophe which would probably have destroyed the military strength of the country for a long time to come. But France was spent and at the limit of her resources. It would take her 4 years to recover. The chief contribution to the salvation of France had been the pitiful leadership of von Moltke, the German commander-in-chief. He never went near the field of battle, his information was always late, as were his decisions, which were nearly always based on indirect information. So delicate were von Moltke's nerves that he was given to crying at moments when it was imperative he have nerves of steel. Prince von Wendel visited Moltke's general headquarters in Luxembourg during those crucial days. When I was presented, the visitor recounted, I was appalled at the appearance of the chief of the general staff, slumped down at his desk with his head in his hands. When Moltke raised his eyes, he showed me a pallid face wet with tears. I am too heavy-hearted, von Moltke confessed. William II, who was ignorant of military realities and who never exercised his power as commander-in-chief of the army from 1914 to 1918, had made a poor choice in the commander of his troops. At the end of a month and a half, he would find it necessary to replace Moltke. He succumbed under the weight of his responsibilities, Prince von Bülow would later say. At the crucial moment, the reins slipped from his weak hands. The staff and junior officers prevailed. The high command failed in its task. Bülow recalled an aphorism from the past. More than 2,000 years ago, a Greek philosopher taught that an army of deer commanded by a lion was superior to an army of lions commanded by a deer. In August and September of 1914, Moltke had an army of lions at his disposal. Marshal Foch would say of it that it was the best army the world had ever seen. But the commander of the lions had acted like a deer. Instead of keeping a stout heart, he had defeated himself. Could he have acted otherwise? The answer is yes. For a moment, he even thought of doing so. Then, weak-willed, he gave up, and on September 10, 1914, he ordered a general withdrawal. It was an unnecessary move, for the Allies had discontinued their offensive. The French and the English, stated Prince von Bülow, felt so little like victors that they did not harass the Germans as they retreated. The French, like the Germans, were on their last legs. From the Meuse to the Marne, they had left hundreds of thousands of men lying dead and wounded. Both armies were at the end of their strength. The French artillery had, in just a few weeks, expended half of its ammunition reserves. Ammunition was stingily supplied, not even 5 million shells on the first day of hostilities, although French guns would fire 300 million in the next 4 years. Machine guns, the only effective weapon for fighting at close quarters in a war in which from the first day millions of men faced each other, were almost non-existent. The French Air Force consisted of 160 planes. The pilots were still armed only with rifles, and almost never hit anything. Tanks had not yet been developed. The only true weapon during those first 5 weeks of the War of 1914, August 4 to September 10, would be human flesh. The French army, before the end of 1914, would see its casualties rise to 900,000, 300,000 killed. They would continue to grow. The final cost of the war to the countries involved would be 8 million dead and 32 million wounded. Meanwhile, in mid-September 1914, the French army, after a successful counteroffensive lasting a few days, found itself winded and unable to exploit its brief advance. By September 17, 1914, it was over. The French pursuit had been halted at the Aisne. General de Castelnau, mustachioed old gentleman of strong Catholic faith who had been put in command of a new French army, tried to take Amiens. His counterattack was brief, he was thrown back at the Somme. General Maudhuy, who had launched an attack with fresh forces between Bethune and Arras, was no more fortunate, and was driven back to Albert. The Germans took only 15 days to break up the French counteroffensive. Joffre tried once again to pull his forces together. The British Expeditionary Corps, after sending off several hundred thousand dead and wounded to the cemeteries and hospitals, received reinforcements from Great Britain. The Belgian army had evacuated Antwerp and could be used again. Foch was ordered to join forces with both the British and the Belgians to extend the offensive northward. He was an optimist. During the Battle of the Marne, he had thought it won. "The war is practically over," he wrote at the time to Clemenceau's brother. Since he was still convinced that he would be able in short order to march into Berlin on horseback, he was entrusted with an operation that might build on the victory of the Marne, encircling the Germans with the left flank of the Allied front. The objective was Ostend and the North Sea. With his left, Foch planned to skirt the German right. He had been given solid French divisions from various sectors. In addition to the survivors from the Belgian Army and the British Expeditionary Corps, he had sailors from the French Navy at his disposal, to be used as infantry on this occasion. The Germans, despite being compelled to give way somewhat by Joffre, were not really beaten. They had given up a bit of terrain north of the Meuse, but they still occupied the richest and most strategic regions of France. The new commander of the German army, General von Falkenhayn, had been reinforced by 200,000 new soldiers, a great many of them volunteers, the elite of the German university youth. The French and Germans alike would fight furiously for several weeks. Result: a draw. Foch would not get to Ostend. Falkenhayn would not get to Calais. The Belgians, outflanked at the threshold of the North Sea, opened their floodgates, inundating the field of battle. The battle veered off towards Ypres. Falkenhayn sent his regiments, manned by students burning with intense patriotic fervor, to attack the Flemish village of Langemarck. There they were massacred by the thousands. The British commanders readied a second time to scurry off towards their ports. The billowing sea tempted them, and Foch was hard-pressed to get them to stay on French soil. Yet his famous hook hooked nothing. By mid-November 1914, it was evident to the Allies as well as to the Germans that they were both stalemated. Each failed in turn, reaping nothing but tens of thousands of additional deaths. Poincaré's victory parade of 1914 was at an end. On November 29, 1914, one of the most brilliant generals of the French army, shocked to hear high-ranking French officers at a meeting of the general staff at St. Pol advocating renewed, murderous attacks by their exhausted troops, retorted furiously, "Attack. Attack. It's easy to say, but it would be like knocking over a stone monument with your bare hands." A British military critic commented, "Their attempts were no more effective than a mouse nibbling at a strongbox." But the teeth being used were the living strength of France. Poincaré's divine moment was about to turn into a four-year-long French martyrdom. Several million Germans and Frenchmen, bloody troglodytes of the 20th century, would thenceforth live buried in holes, haggard, helpless, hunkered down under a rain of hundreds of millions of kilos of death-dealing machine gun bullets. The Russian government, on the other side of Europe, did not march triumphantly into Berlin by All Saints' Day of 1914. The victory of the little German army, the protective screen of nine divisions which triumphed over Sassenach at Tannenberg, was completed during the same days as the Battle of the Marne by another Russian disaster suffered by General Rennenkampf at the Masurian Lakes. The Russian losses were twice those of their German assailants. Nevertheless, the Russian soldiers fulfilled the role assigned to them by Poincaré of diverting part of the Reich's troops toward the east, although they paid an extremely high price for that support. Russian blood was also costly to the Germans. Weakening their offensive in the west had caused their drive against Paris to fail, and the Germans lost their chance to destroy the French army. The Russian armies harvested nothing but disasters. They offered a stiff opposition to the Austrians, beating them in several important local battles, but gained no decisive result. Russian forces were not able to penetrate to the Hungarian plain, nor were they able to join up with the Serbians, their stepping stone to the Balkans. That was the essential thing for the Russians, the very purpose of their Pan-Slav war. They had demonstrated that left on their own they would probably never reach Belgrade, let alone Constantinople. The Russian armies had scarcely engaged in their first battles before Slav imperialism would be revealed as an enormous bluff. The giant had feet of clay. Russia's military command, and her political administration as well, were dens of insatiable grafters who had embezzled away a large portion of the French credits obtained to reinforce Russian military strength. Stocks of material supposed to have been supplied by the billions of gold francs from Paris were non-existent or comprised of defective goods. The commissions charged by the French and the depredations of Russian embezzlers had completely sabotaged quality. By the second month of the war, September 1914, many of the Tsar's troops lacked rifles, and their artillery had run out of ammunition. The following are samples of SOS messages sent from the Russian front to the responsible officials of St. Petersburg and of General Headquarters, Telegram No. 4289, September 19, 1914, Ministry of War. Secret. Personnel, the field echelon on the road, 150 rounds per gun. The regulating, station echelon, none. Backup supplies are exhausted. The general reserve depots are empty. Message of September 20, from the Commander-in-Chief to the Minister of War. Cabinet. Secret. Staff, Section 1, No. 6284, if our expenditure of artillery ammunition continues at the same rate, our total supply will be expended in 6 weeks. It is therefore necessary that the government face the situation as it is, either the manufacture of artillery ammunition must be considerably increased, or we shall have no means of continuing the war after the 1st of November. Telegram to the Commander of the Army, September 25, 1914, No. 6999, Secret. Personnel, backup supplies at present exhausted. If expenditure continues same rate, impossible to continue war for lack of ammunition within 15 days. It had been that way almost from the first contact with the Germans. Mark Farrow, La Grande Guerre, page 110, wrote, as early as the month of August, the Russian General Rennenkampf made demands on his Minister of War for 108,000 shrapnel shells, 17,000 high-explosive shells, and 56 million cartridges. He was offered 9,000 shrapnel shells, 2,000 high-explosive shells, and 7 million cartridges. Stocks should have been at maximum before the Russians marched. They had been increased only once after the war's beginning. Even then, shipments were 8 times less than what was needed in cartridges and 12 times less in shrapnel shells. An English officer attached to the Russian army could only note, the battles of the Third Army were nothing but massacres, because the Russians attacked without artillery support. The little that the Russian troops had brought along was shockingly defective. At Tannenberg, the Russian machine guns almost all jammed at the end of a few hours. A third of the cartridges failed to fire. Half the artillery shells did not correspond in caliber to the artillery pieces. Renouvin, the French historian, wrote these startling lines, "In Russia, the crisis in material is alarming. The troops lack rifles. The supplies laid in before the war have barely sufficed to cover the losses of the first 2 or 3 months. The factories are not even manufacturing the guns necessary to equip the reinforcements." It was the same with machine guns. The infantry has never had the number of machine guns provided for by regulations, and production is not sufficient to cover losses. As for the artillery, the replenishment of artillery ammunition shows a heavy deficit. The army asks for 1.5 million shells per month, the industry is providing it with 360,000. La Crise Européenne, pages 274f. The Russian army, Renouvin concluded, is worse off than it has ever been. Soon half the Russian infantrymen would be armed only with clubs. General Denikin would write these haunting lines from the front. Two regiments were almost completely destroyed by artillery fire. When after a silence of 3 days our battery received 50 shells, it was immediately made known by telephone to all the regiments and all the companies, to the joy and relief of the men. After listening to the complaints of Grand Duke Nicholas in the latter's command car, the Grand Duke, now pallid and emaciated, his features drawn, Ambassador Paleolog, the French firebrand of St. Petersburg, sent the following dismaying note to his boss, Poincaré. This evening I see the Russian army as a paralyzed giant, still capable of striking formidable blows at adversaries within reach, but powerless to pursue them. By then, half of the Russian army had already been put out of action, more than 2 million casualties, 834,000 of whom had been killed. Like the Russians, the French government at the end of a month was forced to beg for guns, cartridges, and cannon from all over the world, from Portugal, from Spain, and even from Japan. Telegram from the French ambassador at Tokyo, number 36, September 1, 1914, Japan is willing to sell us 50,000 rifles and 20 million cartridges, whereas we most urgently asked for 600,000 rifles. A personal confession by Poincaré. By September 8, there were only 275mm guns in reserve. 50 batteries had been ordered from Creusot, but the firm took 4 months to complete the first four. Poincaré, L'Invasion, page 264. Millerin hoped that we'd be able to buy the batteries in Spain and in Portugal. Poincaré, op. cit. The Model 1886 rifle was being manufactured at the rate of 1,400 per day. 1,400 rifles for an army of more than 2 million men. And rifles, moreover, of a model already more than a quarter of a century old. And this. What struck Joffre was the shortage of ammunition. Jean Retinaud writes, they went off to war with a supply of 1,390 rounds per 75mm gun. The supplies have fallen to 695 rounds, and only 10,000 rounds are being manufactured per day, for more than 3,500 cannon. Joffre is so concerned about it at this point that the only document he carries with him all the time, the one thing he is never without, is a little notebook in which the exact ammunition count is kept. Faro, La Grande Guerre, page 105. 10,000 rounds for 3,500 cannon, that boded less than 3 rounds per day per gun in the future, hardly enough to bracket a target. Joffre went so far as to have the number of rounds fired by the combat units reported to him daily. Here is his order: every evening, or every night before 10 o'clock, each army will inform me by telegram of the number of rounds used during the day. Such was the abyss out of which he would have to climb, with infinite difficulty, while a million French soldiers fell. The essential manufactures would only be achieved by recruiting hundreds of thousands of coolie factory hands in Asia. Only then would it be possible to rebuild a viable French war industry, sufficient to assure the supply of ammunition to the front. In truth, everyone had lost in 1914. No army had remotely achieved its objective. The richest provinces of France, representing 85% of her economic resources, were in the hands of the Germans, 40% of her coal, 80% of her coke, 90% of her iron ore, 70% of her foundries, 80% of her steel, 80% of her equipment. That despite the Marne, a transitory victory that succeeded only in pushing the enemy back from one river to another. At the end of 1914, it was impossible to imagine when France would recover its lost territory, let alone Alsace and Lorraine. Rain and snow fell endlessly on 2 million bronchitic soldiers buried, chilled to the marrow, in long, muddy trenches. 100 meters from the French, the barbed wire, machine guns, and cannon of another 2 million soldiers, Prussians, Württembergers, Saxons, and Bavarians, barred all access to the north and east. There was no hope of dislodging them from their positions at the beginning of that unlucky winter. Would they ever be driven out? No one ventured any longer to predict. France's wonderful war had sunk into a morass of millions of bleaching bones. Britain's leaders had no more cause for rejoicing. 100,000 Tommies had fallen. The rest were floundering in a foreign land, chilled by the North Sea booming behind them, demoralized by the shells falling on their flat helmets, inverted soup bowls on which the shrapnel rang like sleigh bells. Hindus came to the rescue of the British. And New Zealanders. And Australians. All were bewildered at having to fight and die for local quarrels they knew nothing about. What could a Flemish village with a collapsed bell tower mean to a citizen of Sydney? And whose interest was he really defending in those putrid marshes? The war seemed prehistoric and absurd to all of them. Marshal French was right, they must have said to themselves, in wanting to lead them out of this vile mud and regain the tranquility of their native hearths in England or Scotland. The Russian leaders had foundered even more completely than the British and the French. They had learned in that autumn of 1914 that they could never win with only their own forces, and that this war, which they had envisioned as the annihilation of the Germans by the French, had turned into a gigantic slaughter of their people. Now, they were running short of everything, arms, material, men. Despite Austria-Hungary's weaknesses, Germany would pound Russia harder every day with her enormous iron mace, as the Teutonic Knights had done hundreds of years before. The long-suffering Russian people would in the end escape from the clutches of the rabble-rousing Grand Dukes. Imperial St. Petersburg already knew it, sensed it, and even smelled the catastrophe. For the Serbs, although they had been able to contain and even repulse the Austrians in the beginning, the battles had served no purpose. Germany was watching and could invade Serbia at any time. Russia had come to a standstill in her campaign to reach Serbian territory, she would never succeed. For the Allies, 1914 was marked by catastrophe. On the German side, it had been the same. The Kaiser's victory in the West, almost achieved by the end of August 1914, had sunk beneath the waters of the Marne. To win the war with Russia, Germany needed to have finished the war with France in no more than 7 weeks. Germany had defeated neither France nor Russia, and she found herself irretrievably involved in wars on two fronts, which in 1914 had seemed impossible. She found herself in the middle of a double conflict. In the West, German armies had occupied a considerable territory in vain, the Germans were condemned to immobility, exactly like the French, the British, and the Belgians opposing her. In the East, Germany had warded off a savage invasion. The Russians had only rudimentary weapons to fight with, and sometimes none at all, but there were millions of them who would march en masse to death. Vast reaches of space stretched away towards the Urals and the Yenisei. To venture, there would be to drown, to be swallowed up, to be frozen. The Austrians, who might have been able, that August of 1914, to chastise the Serbians if they'd had only dealt with them, had suffered one reverse after another, like a blind man stumbling from one pothole to the next. All of them, absolutely all of them, had failed. The future loomed before them like a great wall that could no longer be broken through or scaled by any of them. The warring governments would have to invent myths and pretexts, to offer fabulous material advantages in order to lure millions of other men to replace the fallen combatants and die like them. How would they be able to convince some, cajole others? In the name of what?